Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, a place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. And I'm David Todd. It's Season 8, Episode 50. It's Thanksgiving week. It is Packers week. And it's a Sunday night game on national television as the Steelers, as we've talked about, are going to play a stretch of games in primetime or national television here until the final week of the season in great shape in the AFC North. And Dave, happy Thanksgiving to you, and very importantly, happy Thanksgiving to all our listeners all around the world. I know it's not necessarily Thanksgiving for those in Canada and a lot of, you know, basically everywhere outside the United States, but it's a special time and a time to give thanks, and certainly thanks for you and all that you've done for the podcast, and certainly our listeners make it happen. And thanks to them.
Yeah, you know, back at you, as is easy way to say it there. I don't get interested in many holidays, to be honest with you, David, but there's something about Thanksgiving that really kind of always excites me. We usually do the same. Check this out. You might not believe this. We do the same thing every year. We go. I know that everybody, there's no shock faces listening to this podcast right now. I am, if there was a creature of habit, David, it's me for sure. And you know, the last several years, we've kind of made it a habit to pick up the fixings from Honey Baked Ham, you know, a few days early. Before Thanksgiving, and then kind of start munching on it from Wednesday on, and make kind of a 4-day ordeal out of it. And it's real stress free. And of course, with normally when the Steelers don't play on Thursday night, I'm able, on Thursday at all, or Thursday night, obviously with Thanksgiving, then I'm able to sit back and watch all the games, and you know, make several trips down and eat on some pies and all like that. So really, I'm really looking forward to these next several days. And we already got the fixings yesterday. Chase them down. So we've already started Thanksgiving in our house here. And let me just start off this podcast by kind of an old intro to a soap opera, which I think is kind of appropriate here. Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our Steelers lives. For those not familiar with that, Days of Our Lives, a soap opera. I don't even know if that's still on the air now, David, but I know it ran couple of decades there. Boy, it's always something else with the Steelers, right?
It is, and we'll get into that in 1 second. I want to throw out to you that we'll have a beat writer today. We'll have Michael Cohen from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is going to join us toward the back end of the show. So we'll preview the Packers as we do every Wednesday. Also, we put a poll up, and just, you know, look, we try to make this show, we try to have fun ourselves. And hopefully when we're having fun, that makes it interesting and entertaining for you guys who are listening. But I just asked, you know, what's the ideal length of the podcast for you to consume? Because Dave and I consume media in different ways, and I know a lot of people do different things. And I just wanted to know, as we've, some of the podcasts have run a little bit longer over the past month or two, if that people find that inconvenient, or, you know, the material's not good enough or whatever. So I basically gave you four choices, 30 to 45 minutes, 45 to an hour to an hour 15, or whatever, however long it should be if it's good content. And not surprisingly, the last answer of whatever is fine as long as it's good content was the winner at 44%, and basically the other three came in at 20%. So Dave and I are going to continue to try and shoot for, you know, use an hour as our barometer. If it comes up 10, 15 minutes shorter than that, so be it. If it's 10 or 15 minutes longer than that, so be it. But we just wanted to get some feedback. We got, you know, the poll's still open if you want to vote, but it's going to be hard to statistically change that at this point. We have 800 votes in there. But you can find that under the Twitter feed of Terrible Pod, at Terrible Podcast, if you're interested to just check out the numbers. But that's where we stand, so that's where we're going to go going forward. So
quick note on that. You know, Ron Lipick, a guy who does contributions for the site, and a lot of people probably familiar with his work. He has a book out, Steelers Takeaways, and you know, he's been providing great exclusive interviews with Steelers of the past on the site. Well, he put he responded to that poll with kind of an infographic that says 22 minutes. He says and this infographic is really the average is perfect length for a podcast. The average podcast listener stays connected for 22 minutes on average. Studies show that students zone out after 15 to 20 minutes of lecture time. After 20 minutes, attention and retention rates crash. Well, then we had Carrie at underscore Carrie P respond to Ron on Twitter. She said, this may be true. However, not every lecturer makes pop culture references from the 1970s and is asked to pronounce Latin words. goes on to write, now that will keep you focused and entertained. So carry on, Dave T and Dave B. With in parentheses here, besides, I have a pause button if I need it. She ends it with dilly dilly there. I think that is kind of what half the reason these things run long anyway is because I flap my gums too long. There's been several times where David I know is ready to end the podcast about 15 minutes early, but I won't let him. But we will try to keep it around 60 to 70 minutes. Right around in there. Big thing is just want to make sure we try to get as much information and topics covered as possible. And as David said, we try to have fun doing it. And I think that's the biggest thing. We're kind of a Mutt and Jeff, kind of an Oscar and a Felix, if you will, odd couple. And I think that's what has made this show, work for as long as it has. Carry on.
All right, good stuff. So, let's get to the news of the day. And, of course, the news of the day was the news of a couple of days ago where Marcus Gilbert comes out that he is suspended for 4 days for testing positive for performance-enhancing substances. Gilbert quickly came out with a response that he wasn't going to appeal and he would serve a suspension. He apologized to the organization, his teammates, fans, the standard apology, and said he inadvertently consumed the substance. Two things of note here. One is there were some people who talked about why didn't he appeal and get it cut down. Generally, there is a standard. When we see appeals on suspensions, there's a lot of gray in some of these suspensions that are off the field, whether it be the domestic violence things we've seen, the situation with Ben years ago, or even some things that are just that haven't been encountered before. And some people point to the Le'Veon Bell thing, and that's a little bit of that type of thing. The PED stuff is very black and white. If it's positive, you don't really have a lot of recourse on the test. They're not going to take a game off. I don't think there's ever been a PED suspension in the last 10 years that I can remember that hasn't been 4 games. So that was point one. And point two is obviously, I guess, the Steelers inside the organization. Ben's talked about people being aware that this was coming down the pike. And you look at the schedule, you look at what's going on, and you might as well get it behind you because when you appeal, who knows how that's going to go. Maybe it comes back quickly, maybe it doesn't, but you run the risk of running into the playoffs, and that's obviously more significant than what's happening here. And not that this stuff isn't significant, but the Steelers look like they are certainly playoff bound, and so get it behind them and move forward, Dave, and then we can talk about the ramifications of that from there.
Yeah, and Ben, on his radio show, on his weekly radio show on Tuesday, said that, him and a few of the teammates knew, I'm not convinced maybe they knew as far as 2 weeks out. Maybe they did, but evidently known for a little while that Gilbert was, facing a possible suspension here. And he talked a little bit about, they were talking that, that they really were hoping that he wouldn't appeal it because, as you said, look, I mean, who wins these things, you know? And it's better to, instead of getting this thing kind of tied up, and yeah, maybe he's afforded the opportunity to play one extra game against the Packers, but push come to shove, I think they all are resigned to the fact that he's going to miss four games. So why not get it started and out of the way now? And I wrote my immediate reaction to this, David, was a optimistic one, and I immediately opened up a post and started writing about it, and had a post banged out probably within an hour after the news was announced. To me, there are some bright sides to this. The first and foremost being that you're going
silver linings. Let's call them that, right?
Silver linings and playbooks. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, that's where we're going. Yep.
Is that your favorite movie?
No, because the gambling aspect of that is so far off the reality of gambling. I actually hated it.
Okay, you would not be surprised for me to tell you I have not watched that.
Yeah. I got dragged there about 3 years ago this week, or maybe it was Christmas week, and I remember because I don't go to many movies either, and this was like, oh, you know, it's about football and whatever, and I watched it, and it wasn't good.
I'm assuming that was a woman that did that. The great Melanie's girl surgeon, in fact, in response to our poll the other day, said she could, you know, she could sit and listen to us as long as we're willing to talk. And I said, well, that's some words that you'd never hear out of my wife.
Yeah, right.
But back to Marcus Gilbert here. My first thought was, okay, he's going to miss four games. You get him back at the end of the season, he'll be able to have some tune-up games against the Texans and if need be against the Browns. So that's good in that aspect. The four games off will also, I mean, this is a guy that has struggled with hamstring injuries this year, and although he looks like he's over that now, maybe this extra time will give him even more time to kind of strengthen that up and make sure that's behind him. Once and for all. And really the kind of last aspect of it is Marcus Gilbert has already missed five games this season and parts of two others. And Chris Hubbard has, and we'll get into this part of it now, I'm sure, has filled in admirably for him. And, he's used to playing the position now, in having him start at right tackle. You obviously don't have him as a extra lineman blocking tight end, if you will. But make no mistake, the Steelers have won some games this year without Marcus Gilbert at right tackle. You obviously would rather have Marcus Gilbert in there, but this isn't a jump off the bridge situation in my eyes. Now, Roethlisberger also said Tuesday that he believes that, you know, Marcus Gilbert did not purposefully put anything into his body that he thought would run a chance of him getting suspended here. Now, Gilbert has obviously been in the league a long, long time. You have a guy in your own locker room in Ramon Foster that seems to be very, very in tune with what happens with the NFLPA, and thus all, you know, the lists that come out of banned substances and products and this, that, and the other. Push comes to shove, David. I the longer I thought about heard Roethlisberger talking, of course, you know, yeah, I know Roethlisberger's going to defend Gilbert. That's to be expected. I actually believe that Gilbert didn't purposefully do this. However, I do believe he was very negligent in maybe going to somebody and them saying, look, you know, we've had, this is 100% not going to get you. It's approved, this, that, and the other, before him doubling back and checking and triple checking that whatever he took, it was on the banned substance list. If he just played Russian roulette to the fact that I don't think I'm going to get tested and I want to get back from this hamstring injury, then he's incredibly, incredibly stupid. Because, you know, masking agents and all like that, I accept the fact that there's probably players that have been able to figure something out, but sooner or later the back end catches up with you, and then you have to come up with more masking agents. So I believe the fact that he didn't purposefully do this, but still the negligence on his part to not double and triple check, it opens him up for criticism, you know, from fans and whoever.
Yeah, I'm surprised I'm the greater cynic in this one than you. One is, I think plenty of players in the league use PEDs. As always, the users are way ahead of the testers. It's amazing to me. I think one of the things I find more interesting than anything sports related, anything related to sports in our society, is how users, guys who get busted in Major League Baseball, are absolutely tarred and feathered, and they are really scarlet. They wear a scarlet letter for the rest of their careers when they break the rules of the game in that respect. And in football, guys serve their four games and come back, and nobody thinks twice about it, whether it's Brian Cushing or Antonio Gates, or I could put a list of 20 names down, and I'll tell you, somebody could do the same to me, and I'd forget that 15 of these guys got nailed at some point in their careers. And I'm sure we will with Marcus Gilbert, and I'm sure, you know, most people do with most players in the league. And I don't know why that is, but it's a cultural thing where it is a massive stigma in the game of baseball, and it's much less a scarlet letter in the NFL, and we move forward from it. In terms of Gilbert specifically, the guy's a seven-year veteran. What's on that list of banned substances doesn't change on a weekly basis. He got busted apparently for Andro, which is basically a drug from the 1940s. I mean, you know, I'm joking, but I mean, this is like, you know, East German swimmer type stuff. This is not cutting edge. So I don't know if he mistakenly ingested something without paying attention. I'm a little bit more cynical. Seven-year veteran in the league, I think he generally knows what he's doing. It's no coincidence in my mind that it happened when he's trying to return from a recurring injury. This was him trying to get back on the field more quickly. And, you know, the reality is either way, whether Dave's right, it was just by accident and a dumb accident, or me, it was a more knowing mistake. It's going to cost him a lot of money. Now, it's going to cost him $1 million, let's say, in round numbers. But when you get to – and this is all the question about guys who use performance-enhancing drugs. Wherever you are on the scale of player, a fringe major leaguer or NFLer or the elite – if you get to sign that next contract, and Marcus Gilbert did get, you know, roughly a $25 million contract or $30 million, then, you know, does it pay for itself to get you there if you get there? Now, he's made his money. I'm not suggesting that this was all about his next contract, but there is a financial implication to it all. And then circling all the way back to Dave's point, to me, we can get into the statistical minutiae of Gilbert and Hubbard, and there's so many other variables when we talk about one football player being on the playing field and how that impacts the data, that I'm not sure that it's overly insightful in terms of the details of the numbers. But the general point is the Steelers have performed as well on a per-play basis with Hubbard in there as with Gilbert in there. And that's, you, in terms of getting the general direction of the argument right, I think that's the important part of the argument. I know that a lot of people are out there throwing around red zone data. I can't tell you how statistically insignificant I think that is. The data points to the Steelers being much better with Gilbert on the field than Hubbard, but there's so much noise in red zone data. You know, where in the red zone did these drives take place? Did you get the ball from the 35 to the 5, or did you start from the 21 to the 19? Who else was on the field? Somebody mentioned, I think, was Foster, you know, playing in those games. Did the Steelers try to run and pass? Who was the opponent? What were the weather conditions? When you're looking at a sample size of 10 to 20 red zone sample sizes and comparing them with different opponents, to me, there's almost no statistical significance to that part of the data. The more robust data, the per play data, when you have hundreds of plays, I think is more significant to kind of, you know, at least filter out some of that noise. That doesn't even filter out all the noise, but some of it. And I think that tells you that, look, there's a reason Gilbert's the starter and Hubbard's the backup. But I think we've seen from Hubbard's play, not quite as good a pass protector. but there shouldn't be a huge drop-off. Now, obviously, if Hubbard or somebody else were to go down, it impacts your depth at the position. That could be significant. But to me, short-term impact here for the Steelers, very, very insignificant.
And, you know, immediately, you know, people want stats, David, because they want to validate or not validate a narrative when it comes to will there be a drop-off or this, that, and the other. But even there, and look, nobody likes stats more than me. We have a great charting department, if you will, at Steelers Depot. Matthew Marksey and Alex Kozora do fantastic jobs, and we chart damn near everything, Dave. We chart where a guy lines up, little things, whether or not he's on the move now. Pretty much every, and we're always trying to evolve that as well too. So it makes it fairly easy for me to pull data now for when a guy lines up at right tackle for a run. I can eliminate kneel downs, scrambles, aborted plays, quarterback screen, all that kind of stuff. And when you do whittle that kind of stuff down, you know, the raw stats tell you yards per carry wise that Hubbard, that the offense has actually performed better from a yards per carry aspect than they have with Gilbert at right tackle. Now, on a success percentage rate, the two are really right there with each other, with Gilbert, the Steelers actually having a higher successful run play rate by about a full percent over Hubbard. But the fact is that number 40.2% for Hubbard and 41.1% for Gilbert, yeah, those are comparable. But even so, as we've talked, I think even on the last podcast, that success rate needs to be around 43-44%, regardless of who's in there. Now, you can break this, and I did, I whittled this down even further. You can break it down to yards per carry on runs to the right side of the middle of center. And even in doing so, Hubbard's numbers look far more superior than Gilbert's, as does his successful run rate on runs to the right. You get into the, and I've got all the passing numbers up as well, too, and I even put in the red zone efficiency numbers. Yes, it's a noticeable difference efficiency-wise when Gilbert's in there at red tackle in the red zone as opposed to Hubbard. But once again, you have so many moving parts, and really to kind of tear down my own stats, when you look at and you try to break down, you know, runs to the right side, you know, did somebody pull on that play? Did you have an extra tight end or a fullback on that play? You could whittle these things down in so many different directions and then cherry pick them to make probably the stats match whichever one you want the right tackles to have had perform better when they were on the field. I think the gist of what and why I did it overall, not only because of the demand, I think the point that I'm trying to get to is the fact that, yes, you obviously would like Marcus Gilbert on the field during these next four games, but we have seen some bad tackle play across the NFL this year. Some where it makes you hold your breath, either left or right side, you know, on some of these, for some of these teams, every time a ball snapped, especially in pass protection. Chris Hubbard is not, in my opinion, a hold-your-breath kind of guy. I think he has represented himself well. I think even earlier on during the season, David, you and I talked about Hubbard's run blocking is something that he excels with. Obviously, you would like him to be better as a pass protector, but I think we only have him down as allowing one sack this season. Now, he's obviously given up his share of pressures, but Gilbert, on the same token, has given up a few pressures and a half a sack as well. You're not going to miss Gilbert, I don't think, in the game against the Packers. The Steelers have already beaten the Bengals and the Ravens. Two of these teams are going to play during these next four games. They've beaten them with Hubbard at right tackle. There's no reason to think they can't beat them again with Hubbard at right tackle. And then you get into fourth and final game, which everybody's, you know, freaking out about already, regardless of who of who's playing right tackle. That's the game against the Patriots. And let's be honest, have the Patriots, especially since Hightower and some of these other guys have gone by the wayside, you know, to injuries with them. Is this a team that you think, man, Belichick's going to go into this game thinking, how can I exploit Chris Hubbard and that be the main focus of his defense? I kind of doubt it. You obviously would like Marcus Gilbert in there.
It's the weakest aspect of their team is their pass rush. Their D-line, their pass rush is, you know, it is. Their front seven's their weakness.
Now, of course, so we're going to go out this week and Chris Hubbard will give up two sacks and people will start shaking their head at what we just talked about. But as of right now, I guess what I'm trying to say is don't line up at the bridge right now to jump just because Hubbard's going to start in place of Gilbert the next four games.
Okay, got that covered. We don't know. It's Wednesday. We don't know anything further about where things are injury-wise, but we did hear from Mike Tomlin, and the piece of news that came out of that was Juju's got a hammy. And he said he it appears Juju's going to miss some time in terms of practice. And that tells you something right there, because the Steelers obviously played on Thursday. So if this were a normal week, you know, we'd be at game time. So this means to me that this is not just a as they were talking about it, a slight strain of the hammy. It's a little bit more than that. And I would guess if Juju doesn't go at all today, we won't see him this weekend on Sunday night. And, you know, I don't want to – I've said before, I do not think the Steelers look at the standings or look at the opponent when making decisions about whether guys should play or not. But a Sunday night game in this situation against Green Bay, if there's any question, you would think the Steelers would move on the point of caution, and then the other three guys will kind of see how it goes.
Yeah, Mike Tomlin specifically said a small hamstring injury that might limit him in practicing during the early stages of the week. We'll see what Wednesday's injury report says. If he's at least limited and can go full on Thursday and Friday, I think he's good to go. But if he has back to back, look, the kid just turned 21 today. that's some young soft tissue right there. here's the hope that he can put it to you this way. If I had to bet right now, Juju's going to play against the Packers Sunday night. But obviously, I think the practice report will tell us a little bit more starting obviously later on today with Wednesday, which, you know, probably wouldn't be shocking to see him being limited there. As far as the other guys, Mike Tomlin said Joe Hayden with that fibula will be out once again. No shocker there. Looks like Hayden's back riding on an exercise bike again. Mike Tomlin would not even speculate or give a timetable on a possible return for Hayden. That's not surprising. Mike Mitchell with an ankle. Tight end Vance McDonald with an ankle. Tomlin really didn't provide much of it. I expected Tomlin to come out and say something along the lines that, we think we're going to be able to get these guys back this week, but he didn't really provide a much of an update on either one of those two players outside of saying both will be watched during practice this week. And really no update on James Harrison and his supposed back injury. But James Harrison posted something on Instagram, I think, Sunday during the games, whatnot, said he's back for whatever that's worth. He might be back. He might practice fully today, David. But I don't know. This inactive list is going to fill up quickly. And, you know, if a guy like Juju doesn't play, then you're probably going to get a guy like Justin Hunter back in uniform. I think, and probably this is the next direction that you're going to go here with rookie cornerback Cameron Sutton. I think it's going to come down. I think really the only question mark outside of maybe Juju right now on a team's inactive list would be whether or not the team decides to address Brian Allen or rookie cornerback Cameron Sutton.
Yeah, I've been pretty straightforward on my views on Cam Sutton. He's not going to play this week. Unless he just gets a hat because they had one to give away, nobody's going to sit because no healthy player is going to sit to get Cam Sutton a helmet. And I would be shocked if Cam Sutton returns punts at any point this season. I know people have talked about that as, you know, looking for alternatives in the return game. And I was a bit harsh on AB for his performance a couple weeks ago. Look, AB is going to be the guy, it appears. Eli Rogers is the backup to AB. They're not going to break Cam Sutton in the last 4 weeks of this season and figure out if he can return punts. That would just that would blow my mind in terms of Mike Tomlin's history to see him do that. So I don't expect to see him, you know, this week. And then he's going to get the practice time. That's valuable stuff. But I wouldn't expect to see him get a helmet unless it's, again, injury leads to that, because he's not going to jump, in my mind, in the last 4 weeks of the season. He's not going to jump in front of anybody on the depth chart.
You know, maybe, just maybe, once he's winning, if he does start dressing, especially later on in the season, maybe you can get him some dime snaps, you know, maybe in place of a guy like William Gay. But I think a barring injury, I think that's kind of the best case scenario of him getting defensive snaps moving forward.
Yeah, certainly the Browns game, if that game's meaningless, you'd expect to see him play and get reps.
Well, and if you're going to do that, maybe you try to get, I don't know, do you let him try to play outside in that situation or inside in a dime or a nickel type situation. So, look, it's a good prop. Depth is a good prop to have, but as Mike Tomlin made sure to point out, he hasn't played yet. I mean, we've obviously seen him for a few snaps during the preseason, and if you watched his career at Tennessee, I understand Mike Tomlin's history. Nobody understands it more than I do when it comes to A, not letting rookies get back there normally and function as a return man. But be a defensive one at that. I think you have to go back all the way back to Allen Rossum several years ago to be the last quote-unquote defensive player to return punts for the Steelers. But, you go back to, 2010 with A.B. and Emmanuel Sanders. It's not, we can't slam dunk and say that he hasn't given some young players opportunities to function as return men. And if there's one guy that I think I'm curious about to maybe see possibly return some punts, it's Cameron Sutton, because this was a guy that I think his next to last year at Tennessee led the nation. Okay. In that he has some fantastic returns underneath his belt. Now, Is Tomlin gun-shy after putting Eli Rogers back there? And Eli, obviously, not really a rookie, but, I mean, technically, a young player. Had the muff and haven't seen him back there ever since. And obviously, do you want to – the age-old question of how much wear and tear is Antonio Brown really taking back there returning punts? Not a lot, but, one big hit and people will be hollering to get him the hell out of there. I'm with you to the fact that I think there's a slim chance that Cameron Sutton is given a chance to return punts, but I think I give him a better chance than maybe you do, if that makes sense.
Okay, fair enough. Dave, anything else from Mike or Ben that got your attention?
I mean, it was really a short press conference, right? I mean, they didn't get a lot to.
Nobody was there, apparently.
Yeah, they didn't really ask a lot. You know, he didn't have much to say about Gilbert outside of look, you just read the repercussions of it more than anything. What they're going to have to do moving forward here. No, I guess in summation, no, nothing from Tomlin really caught my eye other than what we've already covered. Ben, had some things to say about the no huddle. I'm going to go back and listen to that interview. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that on Friday as well, too. In the meantime, this is a game at home, against the Packers. We're fixing to preview it here with Michael. This is a game you expect big things out of, right? I mean, more no huddle. Defense should be able to tee off on a young quarterback in Brett Hundley as well, too. And does it worry you at all that, 14-point favorite here?
No, not at all. I said on Friday I would not want to be the Packers. I would not want to be the Packers for this game. Thinking about who you're picking and whatever, 14-point lines, this is when you lay 14. The Steelers have been good on national TV. They get up for these games. It's a holiday weekend. Yeah, it's the back end of a holiday weekend, and people are going to work on Monday. But I expect the Steeler, you know, the crowd, the environment to be really electric, even though it's not a conference or a divisional, or even, to be honest with you, even not that meaningful a game in terms of where the upset to happen. Then you start to think about things. But this is a game where I expect the best. I expect the Steelers to play their best football of the season on both sides of the ball in this game. And to, you know, I wouldn't want to be the Packers.
All right, late last night, talking about Tuesday night, it was announced that Alan Faneca and Hines Ward are once again Hall of Fame semifinalists for this year, 2018 class. Faneca, David, there was probably a time, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, where I thought Hines Ward was probably a shoe-in to eventually get into the Hall of Fame. I have since kind of flip-flopped on that, and now I kind of wonder, due to this log jam and what's happening with receivers now quickly behind Hines Ward's career, I'm beginning to wonder now if Hines Ward will ever get in at all, maybe, especially in my lifetime. A guy like Alan Faneca, I think he's going to get in. And really, if there was ever a year maybe for him to get in, maybe it's this year. But yeah, I think you got a guy like Tony Boselli, first year of eligibility, also a semifinalist this year. Do you think, where are you now in your process of determining whether or not these guys get in? Will Alan Faneca get in this year? And if not, will he eventually get in? And I'll ask you the same question about Hines Ward.
Yeah, I've always been on the downside on Hines Ward, and nobody has to tell us that what a great player Hines Ward was. We're all aware. But, you know, Hines Ward to me, look, it's hard for the – and if you saw this list of whatever it was, 27 semifinalists, I looked at this last night, and I got to say, I follow the game of football incredibly closely and have – you know, since the early 1970s, the earliest days. So every guy on that list is basically somebody that I'm familiar with. There might be one name that I didn't get to see or am less familiar with, but all these guys I watched through their time, and cutting that list from 27 to 15 is going to be incredibly difficult, let alone coming up with the 5 to 7 names. Every guy on there has a case to be in the Hall of Fame. And those who don't make it are on a razor thin line of not making it. There are only a few guys who'd say, no, that guy's definitely not going to make it. And for most of the guys in that category, the few that there are, it's a longevity issue. And even somebody like Terrell Davis was able to overcome that, which I was thrilled to see last year. So, you know, you look at this list and it's parsing stuff, and it's really not something that I spend a lot of time on. But I think Hines Ward, because it's very difficult in that room at the end of the day for people to understand, unless they were living probably in the town with the player, to understand the locker room and the leadership and those types of things, the intangibles, even the blocking aspect that is so often brought up with Hines Ward, they're going to look at the numbers. And whether I don't know if it'll be Ed Bouchette the day that Hines is a finalist. He'll probably be retired at that point. But no, I don't think Hines Ward will ever make it. I think Faneca will make it in the next 2 years. I don't know whether it'll be this year or next. But yes, I think Faneca's in, and I think Hines Ward's going to be left on that Hall of Really Great, but not Hall of Fame.
Boy, I mean, look at these names. I mean, Ray Lewis, I mean, is on this list. He's got to get in.
He's in. He'll get in immediately. Randy Moss will get in immediately.
Right. Steve Atwater, Rondé Barber, Tony Boselli. Isaac Bruce has more catches, I believe, in yardage than Hines Ward does. Roger Craig's probably going to have I don't know if Roger Craig's going to have some problems, but Brian Dawkins probably going to have some problems getting in. Torrey Holt, doesn't he have more catches in yardage than Hines Ward does? Steve Hutchinson, what a great offensive lineman he was. Joe Jacoby, wow, I mean, one of the Hogs, right? Edger and James going to have a hard time getting in. Terrell,
I think he'll get in someday.
You think Edger gets in someday?
Yeah, it'll be good. But again, you know, it's like Jerome Bettis. I was, you know, Bettis for me was a dead on the fence guy. Edge is going to be one of those guys too. The thing that the running backs have that the receivers don't is running back numbers aren't going up, and receivers numbers are all going up as time goes by.
Ty Law, Ray Lewis, John Lynch, Kevin Mawai, Carl Mecklenburg, what was he, a center with Denver? Was he a center or guard with
it was
with,
a no, Mecklenburg was a defensive lineman, a big, you know, big, long, lanky guy.
I'm trying to, for some reason, I want to put him as being an offensive lineman years ago, but I definitely remember the name. Yeah, he was a linebacker for the Broncos, or at least listed as a.
You know, he's a big long. You know, yeah, played in on those Orange Crush teams. I think. Maybe a little bit. Actually, a little bit after Craig Morton in the early '80s, but a big, long, lanky guy.
Six-time Pro Bowler, four-time first-team All-Pro was Mecklenburg there.
Yeah, I think of him as definitely a no-chance guy, and he's a four-time first-team All-Pro. That tells you something.
And if Terrell Owens can get past the maybe, I don't know what. Plain and simple, does Terrell Owens belong in the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
I believe so as well too. And Brian Urlacher's on this list as well too. I mean, is there a chance that either Ray Lewis or Brian Urlacher do not get in this year? I mean, class of 2018.
I think Moss and it's Moss's first year as well, right? I think Moss and Ray Lewis are absolute locks. I would say Urlacher. I'd put him as a first year guy. I'd put him at maybe 60-40. It wouldn't shock me if he didn't get in, but it'd shock me if he wasn't in a year or two from now.
Yeah, and you look at some of these names, especially the wide receivers, and I know wide receiver jams shouldn't matter, but I think it, overall, I think it does, and that's why I just think Hines Ward's just going to sit here. And look, by the time in another few years, David, potentially in three more years, check this out, Antonio Brown, if he stays on his pace, and there's no reason to think he won't, in three more seasons, Antonio Brown will have passed Hines Ward in receptions and receiving yardage. Okay? Is that going to have any of, is that going to quickly diminish Hines Ward's career? As you said, nobody needs to tell us what a great blocker Hines Ward was. And yeah, the Hines Ward rule with the blindside block and all like that. I'm just not convinced. I think it's going to take maybe 20 years from now, maybe a veterans committee, maybe somebody, some young person listening to this podcast, is on that by now, becomes a new Ed Bouchette and trying to make a claim for a guy like Hines Ward of why during his day, he was such a great all-around wide receiver, why he belongs in the Hall of Fame. But like I said, eight, 9 years ago, I figured the Hines Ward might be a kind of a shoe-in, and unfortunately, I don't feel that way now. But I do think that Alan Faneca, gets in, if not this year, maybe the next couple of years.
Okay, let's get to our guest, Michael Cohen of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we'll go over the Packers, and we'll come back and give you our picks for our Thanksgiving Day games and wrap things up. Okay, welcome back. And because it's Wednesday, as always, we have a beat writer covering the opposing team. And we're pleased to be joined today by Michael Cohen, who covers the Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, underscore Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, 13. Michael, appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the Terrible Podcast.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to be here.
Michael, I'd like to start big picture with the Packers and the organization. And when you think about the storied organizations in the NFL, certainly you think about the Packers, you think about the Cowboys, the Giants, the Steelers are in that category. Mike Tomlin has had an extraordinarily successful time in Pittsburgh, but there's a small minority of fans who it's never quite enough. He hasn't won enough Super Bowls yet, even though he's never had a losing season. He takes some heat when things go poorly. Mike McCarthy here. There have been some bumps in the road, and certainly with Rodgers out, things appear more difficult. What's the status of Mike McCarthy in Green Bay?
I think in terms of job security, he's safe. I would be stunned if Ted Thompson made a decision to fire McCarthy after this season, simply because even if everything goes off the rails and they never win another game, you essentially get a free pass. As Rodgers broke his collarbone. Now, right or wrong, I think that's what's going to happen. In terms of the overall perception of McCarthy in Green Bay, I think similar to what you mentioned with Tomlin, there is at least an undercurrent, if not something a little bit larger, of fans who are frustrated with both McCarthy and Thompson for what they perceive to be a continued wasting of Aaron Rodgers' talent, in that they have arguably the best quarterback in the league, perhaps, according to some people, the best quarterback to ever play the game, and yet they've only won one Super Bowl, and they continue to have the same issues on defense that they've had every year, and they still can't find a quality running back to take over since Eddie Lacy has left the franchise. And so I think that there is definitely some unrest among a segment of the fan base, but in terms of what actually matters, and that is Mike McCarthy's relationship with Ted Thompson, I think as long as Ted Thompson is the general manager for however long he wants to keep going, Mike McCarthy will be his coach, and I don't really see anything that will separate those two.
I think we're all in agreement that Aaron Rodgers is the best of the best and will go down as one of the great quarterbacks of all time. It's funny, if every fan base who had a good quarterback won the Super Bowls they should win, think they should win, there would be 10 trophies handed out each year, because we hear the same thing about Ben Roethlisberger's career. Let me ask you very simply about this Packers roster. Is this a good football team?
I think that it is a slightly above average football team. I think that when you look at their wide receiver position with Davante Adams, Jordy Nelson, and Randall Cobb, I think that that's, you know, probably as good of a or close to it as you'll find in the league. So you mark that certainly as above average. I think their offensive line, if they have all five starters, which they currently do not, but if they do have all five, I think that's an above average offensive line. And then you look at the tight end position, I think that's definitely below average. I don't think there's any question about that. And I think their running back position is below average. So what does that tell you? You know, three of the five groups are plus on offense, and two are minuses. So that puts you just a little bit ahead of the curve. And then on defense, you know, that's where things start to get really murky. I think you can say that their pass rush is maybe just a hair above average with Matthews and Perry, but they have no depth. And then you look at their defensive line, and Mike Daniels and Kenny Clark were having really strong seasons, so maybe you give that a plus there. But then as you move toward the back end of the defense, both with inside linebacker and in the secondary, there's been a combination of just not having enough talent as well as having talented players who have underachieved this year. So overall, I think it's, you know, just a slightly above average football team. And then when you have Aaron Rodgers, a guy who is as talented as he is, he can sort of mask a lot of those flaws or deficiencies because of his ability to put up 30 to 35 points every single week.
Michael, before we talk a little bit more about the offense, it sounds like Clay Matthews and Kenny Clark have a good chance of missing the game Sunday night against the Steelers. I think Matthews has a groin injury that he suffered early against the Ravens, while Clark, anybody that watches highlights probably already knows what happened to Clark there, but at least that isn't a long-term injury there. Is that what you're hearing? Both those guys are going to be out. Who are going to replace both those guys? And what about Ty Montgomery? Is he going to be able to return this week? And if not, obviously with Aaron Jones lost for the season, I'm assuming we'll see more Jamal Williams and Devontae Mays.
Yeah, so Kenny Clark, I think, is almost certainly out for this weekend. You know, it's been reported that he has a high ankle sprain, and, you know, I don't think anybody comes back in just a week from that type of an injury. So without him, they'll have to turn to Quentin Dial as their nose tackle. And Dial was a guy that was cut by the 49ers either late in camp or very early in the regular season. I can't quite remember. And they brought him in, and he's actually done a pretty nice job. He's very stout against the run. He's a massive man. He's like 6'5", 318 pounds, but he just doesn't have the lateral quickness or explosiveness that Clark does. So it's a loss in that area. In terms of Matthews, I think he has a better chance to play, but I still think that he probably will be held out this week. And if he doesn't go, you're talking about two guys picking up the slack. Of course, you'll have Nick Perry on one side, so you don't have to worry about that. But then the other side would be split between Ahmad Brooks, another ex-49er who was cut during training camp, and Kyler Fackrell, their third-round pick from a season ago. And when you look at Fackrell, it's a guy that has really underachieved for the first, you know, season and a half of his career. But he started to play better against Baltimore. And if he can parlay that success a little bit into this weekend, it would be a big confidence boost for defensive coordinator Dom Capers, because then he doesn't have to rely exclusively on Brooks, who is 33 years old and probably can't play every snap the way he could, you know, 5-6 years ago. And then on the offensive side of the ball, you know, it looks like Montgomery has a chance to play this week. And if he does, it'll be a 1-2 punch with him and Jamal Williams, as you mentioned. And if Montgomery is unable to go, then there, it would probably be mostly Jamal Williams with a touch of Devontae Mays, because Mays had one of the most unfortunate rookie debuts I've ever seen, where he played from scrimmage for the first time against the Ravens and fumbled each of his first two carries. So he was immediately thrown into the doghouse, and it'll take a while for him to get back out.
When you look at the offense still, of course, minus Aaron Rodgers, I mean, a very, very talented receiving core, Jordy Nelson, Devontae Adams, of course, Randall Cobb, and a lot of people still probably don't know a lot about Geronimo Allison, but really enjoyed watching him ahead of his tape ahead of the draft. The offensive line obviously have had their issues with injuries over the years, but it still looks serviceable on tape. What are they, what, you know, a lot of this obviously falls on the quarterback and Brett Hundley, and going back and watching that game against the Ravens, pretty much miserable there. Are they doing enough to help Brett Hundley? And if not, what do you think they need to do more of, you know, to give him a better chance to succeed?
So the big knock on Hundley coming out of UCLA was that he's never played in a pro-style offense. He's thrown lots of interceptions. He scrambles around outside of the pocket. And so there were a number of scouts and talent evaluators that wondered if he could ever be a true pocket passer in the National Football League. And I think that what you're seeing is a reticence or a large repeated amount of hesitancy to stay in the pocket at this level. You know, a lot of times what Rodgers does really well is scramble. But when you look at what he does when he scrambles, a lot of his mobility and movement is within the pocket. So he'll step back to avoid a rush, and then he'll juke to his right, but he's still in the pocket. He's not running toward the sideline. And with Hundley, you're seeing him bail out of the pocket very, very quickly and go to the sidelines, and then almost exclusively roll to his right and throw the ball out of bounds. And what I think the Packers need to do is essentially tell him, stay in the pocket. You can sidestep a rush. You can step up. You can move left. You can move back. And you don't have to bail all the way out of the pocket, because there aren't – it's difficult to win in the National Football League if you can't complete passes from the pocket. But with the exception of maybe a timing slant route that he's done pretty well with Devontae Adams, he has not shown the ability to throw from the pocket. And so that's what I really think the Packers coaching staff needs to do, is sort of, you know, pummel it into him that he can't just bail out of the pocket on every single play. And he has to trust that he has a decent offensive line that will give him a little bit of time if he hangs in there.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that works for him again this week. It's one of those things that you talk about, that skill, and everybody talks about Tom Brady and his ability to move. So, you know, everybody knows the lack of mobility that Tom Brady has, but that ability to move within the pocket, Dan Marino, Tom Brady. I mean, Rodgers has the unique ability to not only do that, but to scramble outside the pocket. That's been one of the interesting things for us to watch with Ben this season that we've been talking about, whether he'll step up and climb the pocket or whether he'll bail on plays early. So it's something we've been paying a lot of attention to in Pittsburgh as well. Defensively, you know, you look at this and we've seen some guys leave this defense. We've seen some top draft picks, and you've gone through a lot of the specific names. Let me just ask you about former number one picks, HaHa Clinton Dix and Demarius Randall, two guys that obviously that everybody was high on coming out of the draft. Have these guys lived up to the expectations of the organization?
I think that Demarius Randall gets a firm no in that department, and I think Clinton Dix, up until this season, you could say yes, but he has had just a bizarrely poor year for whatever reason. Nobody knows. He's never been on the injury report. I've been told that he's not even receiving treatment for anything, or at least he wasn't as of a week or two ago. So it's not like he has a bunch of minor bumps and bruises that aren't, you know, warranting a spot on the injury report, but are still bothering him. So I've been told that he's fully healthy. And yet for whatever reason, he has just regressed significantly from a season ago when he made the Pro Bowl. I mean, his angles are strange this year. He's not showing up and making big plays. I know that he did have an interception against the Ravens, but that was probably one of just maybe a handful of impactful plays that he's made this season, and nobody really knows why he has regressed the way that he has. So I would say up until this season, he was fine for a performance level of a first round pick, but what he's shown through the first, you know, 2.5-3 months has certainly been a disappointment. And Demarius Randle is an interesting case. He is a guy who has a more far-fetched sense of confidence in himself than any player I've been around. If you ask him, you can ask him today and he'll tell you he's one of the best cornerbacks in the league. And I don't think any personnel evaluator would put him among the best 25 corners in the league. And so it's just very strange the way he sort of carries himself and acts. And, you know, there was an incident earlier this year where he got banished to the locker room in the second half of a game because of an argument with a coach on the sideline. And, there's some immaturity there. Mike McCarthy has admitted that there needs to be some growth on his part. And I think that there are some flaws in his game that make it frustrating for Packers fans to watch him. He has the best ball skill of any defensive back on this team, and he's probably the most physically gifted of any defensive back on this team. But there are times when he shies away from contact, where he doesn't really want to throw his body in there and tackle guys. He doesn't get his hands on receivers in press coverage and looks like he's very slow into his alignment pre-snap, so that it almost looks like he's caught off guard a lot of times when the snap actually takes place. And so there's just some weird issues there with him. And so he, I think, would be labeled as much more of a disappointment than Clinton Dix. But again, he's got the best ball skills, and he had a string of games this year with 3 picks in a row. And so if he can do that, you know, he makes up for a lot of his issues. But I think overall, he's certainly underachieved.
You probably put the Packers kind of middle of the pack defensively in terms of where they stand. There are a lot of different metrics, obviously, that we can look at to figure it out. But if you're Todd Haley and Mike Tomlin and you're putting together an offensive game plan, the Steelers, you know, love the fact and want to be able to do what they want to do. Everybody uses the word balanced, but I'm not sure it's always, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean, obviously, you know, 65 or, you know, 55 passing game, 45 running game. It's whatever you could exploit with the defense, and they have the guys to do it. How do you attack this Green Bay defense?
I think one of the things that you try and do with this defense is take advantage of, you know, their linebackers in play action. And I think the Pittsburgh offense is one that could have a lot of success there. So Blake Martinez, the starting inside linebacker for the Packers and their best inside linebacker, has been an absolute tackle machine this season. And him and Jake Ryan, the other inside backer, they're best when they have to play the run. They're really good at run fits. They can get up in there and make plays either at the line of scrimmage or even a touch behind the line of scrimmage. But what they've been showing this year and in past years is an ability to get sucked into play action where they take too many steps toward the line of scrimmage, and all of a sudden, instead of there being a 10-yard gap between them and the safeties behind them, there's a 15-yard gap between them and the safeties behind them. And I also think that with Bell's ability as a receiver, if they can isolate either Martinez or Ryan or even their rookie safety, Josh Jones, who has tremendous athleticism, but is prone to gambling, trying to make big plays, I think that there's an opportunity for a lot of passes over the middle of the field, you know, just that area in between linebackers and safeties. And then the other area that you attack this defense, and what we've seen lately, is teams are starting to go after cornerback Devon House. And this is a guy that the Packers drafted a number of years ago, a mid-round pick from New Mexico State, who played a few years in Green Bay, then joined Jacksonville in free agency, had one really good year there and one really poor year there. And then he came back and signed this season in Green Bay to be sort of a veteran presence. And he is a guy that he gives you everything he has, but what he has isn't always as good as it needs to be. And so we saw Matt Stafford really pick on him, especially. We saw even Mitchell Trubisky, the rookie for the Bears, completed a number of passes in House's direction, including a deep touchdown down the left sideline, where House just, you know, flat out got beat on a double move, so to speak. And so I think that there's opportunities to go after him. And so when you couple that intermediate passing game with House's, you know, susceptibility to deep balls, I think there's a lot of opportunity there. And Packers are hoping that their run defense can remain stout after 3 good games in a row against Chicago, Detroit, and the Ravens. They've played really, really well. But obviously, as we talked about, the loss of Kenny Clark could influence that. So I think Roethlisberger has a chance to put up some big numbers this week.
A lot of people, in case our listeners forget, Devon House is also the same Devon House that visited the Steelers during the offseason, free agent visit, and then re-signed with the Packers while he was in the facility there. So quite an interesting name. If memory serves me, too, I think Devon House, when he was with the Jaguars, was the guy that Martavis Bryant beat deep on one of those throws a couple of seasons ago there. Michael, when you look at a guy like Nick Perry, is that a perfect example of a guy that it might just take a little while for the light to come on? Because this is a guy coming out of USC that even that year, I think it was 2012, I was thinking, hey, this might be a guy the Steelers are interested in the first round. He obviously ends up in Green Bay, kind of a pedestrian first 4 years. Memory serves me, they didn't pick up his fifth-year option. I think he got a one-year kind of prove-it deal 2016, and boy, did he ever. 11 sacks that season, that turned into a nice contract for him, and of course 7 sacks so far in 2017. Are you surprised at where Nick Perry is now based on the Nick Perry that you may or may not remember back in 2012?
A little bit, yeah. And I think that with Perry, it was never an issue necessarily of talent. He just had a horrible string of luck in terms of injuries. You know, I mean, if you look at the early part of his career, he's only played 15 or more games in the season once, and he's played 14 twice. He's played 11 once. He's played 6 once, and he's constantly banged up. You know, I was looking, I can't remember the exact percentage, but he broke a finger on his hand earlier this year and had to wear a club. And I went back and looked at all the times in his career that he's had to wear a club, and it's something ridiculous. Like, literally almost half of the regular season games that he's played, he's had to wear a club on one hand or the other for various wrist, finger, and hand injuries. It's astonishing. And so I think that he's just a guy that is one of those players that, you know, gets injured very easily. And unfortunately, I think that his early career coincided with a number of seasons when the Packers had Julius Peppers, who, as everybody knows, is a physical freak who has told me that he's never broken a bone. He's never had a concussion. He's never so much as missed a practice unless coaches ask him to sit out. And so I think when you look at the genetic marvel that is Julius Peppers and you juxtaposed it with Perry and all of his injuries, it was sort of like, wow, what is going on? Why can't this guy stay healthy? I mean, look at the other guy. He's in his mid-30s and he's totally fine. And so I think what you saw in that 2016 season that you mentioned was that, again, he stayed healthy for the most part, even though down the stretch he had, I think, 4 or 5 sacks over the last 5 or 6 games, and he was wearing a club for a broken hand down the stretch last year, too. And so Perry, I think, has been okay this year. He's great against the run. That's never a question. His pass rush has been up and down, and, you know, 3 sacks in this most recent game certainly was a little bit of a boon for him. Against the Bears, rather, was a little bit of a boon for him in that it really shifted his season total in the right direction. But there's no question that he is a late bloomer and a guy that it took 4 full years and for him to, A, stay healthy, and, B, put it all together, like you said.
Final question from me before I turn it over to David to close you out here. What are you seeing coverage-wise from them, mostly on the back end? You know, sometimes I see on Twitter, look, we know I'm familiar with Dom Capers, of course. Most Steelers fans should be with his history and, of course, Carolina Panthers and all like that, mostly a 3-4 guy. What are they doing on the back end? How much or roughly what percentage of man versus zone are they playing? I see Packers fans hollering all the time that Capers doesn't play enough man, and I'm doubting that. I haven't watched a ton of film yet on him. I doubt House and Randall travel different sides. They pretty much stay put. Is that right?
Yeah. So this season has been a little bit unique because when they've had their rookie Kevin King in there, the second round pick from Washington, early in the season, when he started to show that he was a legitimate player right away, they were traveling him. And so he traveled with AJ Green when they played the Bengals. And, you know, he's had some success. I mean, AJ Green had a decent day that afternoon, but, you know, there's no doubt that if they have their druthers, they're not afraid to put Kevin King, a rookie, on some of these guys. And I'm looking back through the early portion of their schedule here, because he traveled in a couple of games. They put him on Julio Jones for a decent amount of time in the loss to the Falcons, when they started out without him on Julio Jones, and it was a complete disaster. And then they shifted King onto Julio Jones for most of the second half, and he actually did a decent job against him. And then the following week, as I mentioned, he traveled against AJ Green, and he played a lot against Dez Bryant when they went down to Dallas. And so if he's able to play, now he did not play against the Ravens, but if he's able to go this weekend, I think that they would like to give him an opportunity against Brown and just see what he can do, because he's their guy for the future moving forward. He's their shutdown corner, or what they want to be their shutdown corner. And so when he's healthy, they've tended to play a little bit more man. And when he's not in there, they tend to play a little bit more zone, because they don't really have anyone that can match with some of these really elite receivers. And then, of course, the other thing that you get with Capers is a willingness to blitz, you know, seemingly at any opportunity. Any third and long, he's bringing pressure. And it's almost to the point where, you know, I've talked to some of my colleagues who have covered the team for much longer than I have. And the thing that they always say about Capers is he gets into these situations where he just can't help himself, and he has to keep calling blitzes because that's just sort of what he does. And so you're going to see a lot of pressure, and sometimes you'll see some corner blitzes. You'll see a lot of safety blitzes with their rookie Josh Jones, a really dynamic athlete who can come in off the edge and make plays in the backfield. But I think that, you know, their man-to-zone ratio depends a lot on whether Kevin King is available this weekend. He's dealing with a shoulder problem that dates back to his college career, and he didn't practice much last week, and we'll have to see if he's practiced this week.
Well, Michael, just to wrap things up, special teams, anything of note?
Yeah, so the special teams has been sort of a revolving door at long snapper for the Packers this season. Over the last calendar year, they've only used three different long snappers, but they've shuffled through that rotation like two or three times. And so they ended last season with Brett Goud, and then he became an unrestricted free agent. So they brought in Tabor Pepper, and then they didn't really like him, so they brought in another guy, Derek Hart. And then they cut Derek Hart, and then they brought Brett Goud back, and then Brett Goud got hurt and went on IR. So then they brought in Tabor Pepper, and then Tabor Pepper went on IR. So they brought back Derek Hart, and then Derek Hart was awful, so they cut him. And now they're on Brett Goud again for the third time in the last calendar year.
Wow.
And he is a quality long snapper. He's been with them for a decade. He's just had some injuries that have forced the Packers to go in different directions. But that is just sort of an interesting storyline of how many times they've had to switch long snappers in the last calendar year. So if there are any issues with snaps, protection, that kind of stuff up the middle, it's not necessarily because Brett Goud can't do it, but it's been, 6-7 weeks since he's been asked to do it. And Baltimore was his first game back. So just something to keep an eye on there.
I have to say, I'm shocked that Mason Crosby made it through the gauntlet basically a couple of years ago, when it looked like he was on his last life, you know, but I think about 4 years ago, and still kicking for the Packers. Is the fan base comfortable that when Crosby lines up to kick a 42 yarder, he's going to nail it?
Yeah. Crosby has been really, really good aside from that one down year that you mentioned. And the thing that makes Crosby so reliable for them is that he's extremely good in poor weather conditions. And obviously that's something the Packers need, given that they play in, you know, Northeast Wisconsin, and they're going to have games that are ugly and wet and snowy and cold. And so Crosby has really shown a nice ability to succeed in those conditions. And I remember a game last year where it was, I think it was like December maybe, and it was against the Texans. And over the course of the game, there was probably 3 or 4 inches of snow that fell. And so the field was essentially covered at all times. And Crosby didn't miss an extra point, you know, that day. And his counterpart for the Texans, I can't remember who was kicking. It might have been Nick Novak, maybe. He missed a PAT that was crucial in terms of forcing the Texans to start, you know, being more aggressive later in the game, because it was no longer just a field goal game and they had to go for touchdowns and things like that. And so it's moments like those that may seem small or insignificant, you know, relative to a 55-yard game winner or something like that. But his ability to succeed in questionable conditions is something that the Packers don't take for granted, and is a big reason why they've stuck with him over the years.
Vegas isn't looking for much of a game on Sunday night with the Steelers as a 2-touchdown favorite. Give us a prediction, or, you know, give me a scenario. I mean, obviously the 5-turnover scenario is a good one for the Packers, but is there a scenario where they win this game?
Yeah, I don't see it. I mean, if there is, I don't see it, barring some sort of, you know, injury situation where maybe Roethlisberger goes out or something like that. I just don't see it. I think that I would be surprised if the Steelers don't reach 30 points offensively, and I'd be surprised if the Packers get beyond 17 or 18 offensively. So I think it's going to be something in the range of a 15 to 20 point win for the Steelers.
Hey man, we really appreciate your time. I hope enjoy the matches at the Champions League this afternoon, and safe travels to Pittsburgh. Have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks for making time for us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
Okay, Dave, good stuff from Michael. And, you know, that ran, it was entertaining, hopefully, for our listeners. I mean, we got a lot of insight on a team that's really going nowhere. And I don't know that there is a team, you know, I feel like the Steelers, Dave, would function with Landry Jones at quarterback and still have the potential to be a playoff team. Would they go to the Super Bowl? Highly, highly unlikely without Ben. Ben gives you obviously a bigger chance. The Packers are a team that goes from, you know, a Super Bowl contender to not remotely close to a playoff team without Aaron Rodgers. And I don't know if that's just I do think the Steelers roster is much deeper than the Packers roster, but just goes to show you kind of how great Aaron Rodgers is to lift that roster to Super Bowl contender with his play.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll I'm not looking forward to this game as much as I am maybe the next two after you know, division rivals there. But one thing that you just want to see, you want to see the Steelers go in and totally handle business. In a similar fashion to the way they did against the Titans, against a team that they really should. I think, you know, obviously there's no style points in all these games. Everybody's expecting a huge, huge Steelers win. It would be nice to go in and get something that you expect on a Sunday night in front of a national audience ahead of your next two. In other words, you want to be on a pretty big roll going into the three games that follow. But as we've seen in the past, you find a way sometimes with some of these teams to be scratching your head at 7-3 at halftime, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that one on Friday. Okay, Dave, let's go to the games, and they kind of decrease in interest level as the day goes on. So push your turkey back into the 6 o'clock time frame and enjoy the first two games. Minnesota goes to Detroit. This is a big time game. And, you know, Dave and I have, you know, you've heard us gush glowingly about Matthew Stafford and what the Lions can do. They got a good win last week over the Bears. The Vikings got a very impressive home win over the Saints. The Lions are getting 3 at home, Dave. I like both these teams. I don't understand kind of some of the murmuring about Teddy Bridgewater being the guy with what Case Keenum's done. He certainly has earned his spot. The receivers are great. Their defense is really good. But I'm on the Lions still. And Stafford, I was just looking at some numbers. I think the Lions have put up, you know, I think it's been 8 weeks in a row. They've put up at least 24 points. I love their offense. And I love what Stafford's doing. So I'll take the 3 at home on Thanksgiving in Detroit.
Boy, you got to take your hat off and hand it to Case Keenum, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Adam Thielen, what a stud, right? Diggs over
second
there.
In the league behind AB.
I mean, really, really impressive receiving core over there. The running Murray, the young running back. I don't know why the Raiders let him go, to be honest with you. Nice pickup there. A great fill-in for a guy like Dalvin Cook after he went out injured here. All that said, David, I can't get past the quarterback versus quarterback battle here. And look, the Vikings have a great defense. I think the key this game in Detroit, as usual on Thanksgiving, Matthew Stafford's really done some nice things this year. I think that's the difference in this game. You're showing 3 points on this. I think the Lions win this outright, but if they don't, I only see them losing by one or 2 points. So give me Detroit plus the points at home.
The Chargers have a nightmare schedule down the stretch. It is they don't have any easy games, but you know what? They put themselves in this position at 4-6. But there are a lot of people, and I'm starting to believe that I might fall into this category, that as of right now, the Chargers might be the best team in the AFC West. Paxton Lynch is going to start for the Broncos as they move on to their third choice this year. Yesterday, Ken Norton gets fired by the Raiders as their defensive coordinator, and the Chiefs have struggled. At the end of the day, I think the Chiefs will still be there. Interesting article on The Ringer about Kareem Hunt, if you want to check that out, that I retweeted yesterday. the Cowboys, Ezekiel Elliott out, lose a couple games. They're at home. They get smoked on Sunday night by the Eagles. The whole world was on the Eagles. This game, it's very much mixed. The Sharps love the Chargers on the road, and they don't like the Chargers at home. The Chargers are on the road here, Dave. Now, they opened as a three-point dog. They're now a one-point favorite in what I'm seeing. And you know what? I'm going to take them in Dallas. I'm going to take the Chargers on Thanksgiving in Dallas minus a point.
Boy, what a huge win that would be for them as well. And it would have probably Dallas will still have be on life support a little bit there, but Dallas really has to start winning some games. I mean, they can almost forget about winning that division now with Philadelphia so far ahead. Is Tyrone Smith going to play? I think that's one of the big question marks in this game. It is a short week on top of that. I think, if anything, maybe the short week kind of favors Dallas in this one, David, being as how they are playing at home there. I don't know which way to go with this. Dez Bryant's bound to go off on somebody here pretty soon. I think this could be the game. So I'm going to take Dallas and give me that. What do you have, 1 point?
Yep.
Give me it. Give me that point. Give me the Cowboys at home in that point.
Okay, the Redskins, well, they certainly did the job in terms of if you were playing them last week, getting 9.5 against the Saints. Again, I think they're probably, if you ask teams or guys who cover teams about winning games, then, you know, all games have to be won and lost, right? But 80% of the teams in the world and the people who cover teams think that their team should have won games. It would be 50% losers and 80% winners, because the other team never gets credit. The Redskins, they sure think they should have won that game last week. The Giants finally were in a game and get the win over the Chiefs, a home win, and that'll keep the dogs at bay for at least a few hours. But I expect the Redskins to go off in this one. They're not great defensively. They, by the way, Terrell Pryor goes to the IR. What a disappointing year for him. But I'm going to lay the 7 here with the Skins and expect Kirk Cousins to have another huge game.
Yeah, look, there's not much analysis on my part here when it comes to this game. Give me the Redskins and lay the points.
We've got 13.5, 16.5, and 14-point games coming up on the weekend. So, you enjoy, hopefully, and two 10-point games as well. So you got some huge lines on the Sunday game. So hopefully we get a couple good ones on Thanksgiving. And Dave, wrapping things up again, happy Thanksgiving to you and your wife, and enjoy it. And a very happy Thanksgiving to all our listeners. And thanks. We are incredibly thankful for the support, for the donations, and just for listening. And the feedback, good and bad, appreciate it all. And I'm thankful for a lot of stuff that I have going on here in Pittsburgh with my family and everything else. So a lot to look forward to over the next 24 hours and the weekend.
Same to you, David. I appreciate all you do, and appreciate our listeners as well. To kind of leave, before I get into the final spiel here, for those of you that watched Titus, did you ever watch Titus, the show Titus, David?
I'm not even familiar with it. Don't know it.
Lord, get on YouTube. Well, you want to talk about one of the best sitcoms that probably deserved to run longer? It was Titus. Well, they had a Thanksgiving episode that's probably one of my all-time favorites. And the main character, Titus, gives an opening and ending monologue before each show, kind of humorous. It's really about a dysfunctional family, something I can really relate to. In this particular one, he goes, "Thanksgiving is a holiday that brought together two different cultures. The pilgrims came here with the best intentions. They decided to flee an oppressive people and move to a new land where they thrived and became an oppressive people. You get certain people on the same continent, there's going to be a problem. Pilgrims and Indians, Protestants, Catholics, my family, and anybody else's family." with that, follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on Twitter at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. I think we ran hour 15 minutes today, but that probably deserves a donation from me getting David to take the over here. Go to SteelersDepot.com, hit the donate button upper right navigational bar. David, once again, happy holidays to you, and happy holidays to the listener. We'll be back at it again on Friday.
And to all our listeners, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.